Self-worth. I completely lost myself. I was not a classy drunk. I liked to drink under bridges and freeway overpasses with homeless people. And I never went to a high school party. I prefer dark, dingy, cold, wet places to enjoy my drink. Thank you. Okay. So I took my first drink when I was 14, and the only thing significant about that is that before I took that drink, I was concerned that I was going to be an alcoholic. My mom is coming up on 17 years clean in January, so I was raised knowing about this disease and knowing that it could possibly be a family disease, genetic disease, and all that. And so before I took my first drink, I was scared that I'd be an alcoholic, and my friends looked at me like I was insane. And I took that first drink, and I didn't have that sense of relief or that sense that, I've arrived or anything like that. But in that moment, I knew that I was not an alcoholic, and I could go out and drink and use however much I wanted to after that, which is what I did. And I have, from the very beginning, I drink for oblivion. I drink to escape. I drink because I cannot stand being me. Being inside of my own skin is so painful, and I feel so empty inside, and the only relief I had ever found for that was by getting loaded. And so I have never once tried to control my drinking or limit it or only drink a couple of drinks. I had a purpose when I picked it up, and that was to get obliterated. I wanted to be completely numb. I wanted to black out. I did not want to remember the next day. It was the only time that I felt any sense of relief. So my drinking didn't really, it just went downhill from there. Like I said, I drank under freeway overpasses and in bridges, and that was my life. I went from being a straight A student, a good daughter, a star athlete, to being kicked off of the high school teams that I was on, was barely making D's in my classes, was getting brought home by the police, all that good stuff that happens when we drink. And it was within a matter of months that all that happened, and my parents just were completely baffled. After a while, after numerous times of getting caught, I could no longer use the excuse of, it was my first time, I just wanted to try it. And they started kind of regulating my where I was and what I did and all that stuff, and eventually after another episode of getting picked up drunk and trying to jump out of my mom's car on the freeway, I ended up getting sent to rehab, and I didn't get sober in rehab, but what happened for me there is, other than getting introduced to a bunch of substances I hadn't tried yet, I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was required to go to one or two outside meetings a week. And the first AA meeting I went to was a newcomers meeting in Walnut Creek, which is where I'm from, and some people know where that is. And it was a newcomers meeting, and there were people my age there, and they looked like they were having fun. And this one guy cornered me after a meeting, and he said, "Do you have a sponsor?" I said, "No." And he said, "Here's Heather. She's your sponsor." And I went, "Okay." That woman became my sponsor for probably the next 2 years or so, but it took me about 9 months from that point to actually get sober. I started going to meetings regularly after that, though, And what that did for me is it really screwed up my drinking. And because I started going to these meetings regularly, and I would see people, and I saw the changes in them. I saw them get better. I saw them start to smile. And I was dying inside every single day. Waking up was the worst part of my day because it meant I was still alive and I had to do it all over again. Eventually, after about 9 months of raising my hand for 30 days, my first 30 days, I was in therapy at this time, and for some reason I was always honest with my therapist, and so she knew exactly what I was doing, and she made me tell my parents, she made me come clean to my parents that the entire time, my parents thought I was sober for like 5 months or something, and I would use it against them to let me go out and drink. Like, if you don't let me go out to my friend's house, I'm going to get loaded. And then they'd let me go and I'd go get drunk, and it somehow worked out. But, so she ended up making me come clean to my parents, and I wasn't done. I knew I wasn't done. I knew there was a solution out there. I just didn't think I was ready for it, or if I was ready, it would work for me. That next day, or a week later, whatever it was, I sat down with my mom. I had absolutely no intention of getting sober. I had written like a 10-page letter the night before when I was high out of my mind, describing that I was not done yet, what I had been doing the past however many months I thought I was sober, that I was getting worse, and that I couldn't stop. And that was the first time since I took that first drink that I ever realized that I had a problem. Because every time that I thought I was trying to get sober, like 2 days later when someone would bring something or give me something or whatever it was and I picked up again, I thought I made a choice to pick up. And what it was is that you put something in front of me and that is the only solution that I know that works to make me not feel like me and I take it. And so that was the first time that I realized that I no longer had a choice in this. If you put it in front of me, I'm going to take it no matter what because I don't know how to say no. And so I wrote, put it all in the letter. I told them that I was not going to be getting clean, but maybe one day their pain would help me get sober, and had no intention of getting sober. Sit down with my mom that day, read her the letter, and I just break down into tears, and I asked my mom to help me get sober. She asked me if I wanted to go to a different rehab or if I wanted to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I asked her to let me give AA another shot. I went to a meeting that next day. I found that woman who had been my sponsor for however long before she had fired me. And I told her that I was ready, and I had no expectation of actually staying sober. In my mind, I had tried it, and it hadn't worked. And I went up to her, and I told her I was ready, and I started taking suggestions for the first time in my life because I realized that the way I was living wasn't working. I was waking up dead inside every single day. I was waking up wishing I was dead, but I didn't have the guts to do it myself. At 16 years old, that is not a good way to wake up. It's not a good way to wake up at any time. And so I started taking suggestions and I started working the steps and I started to actually get some relief. It seemed like every suggestion I took, I got a little bit more willingness to take the next one. And all of a sudden I had 30 days and then 60 days. And all of a sudden that pit in my stomach started to lessen a little bit. All of a sudden waking up in the morning wasn't as painful. And it's because I started taking actions in my life that I had never done before. I started going through the book with my sponsor and I started actually allowing myself to relate to the book. The first time I'd gone through it, I would highlight a word on a page, and then this time I was highlighting whole paragraphs because I was allowing myself to find myself in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. During my time in AA, I have been super sober, I've been dry, I've been in a relationship with a stoner musician, I have been always around, never around. I've done all the things they tell you not to do. I've made mistakes. I am not perfect, and that's something I have to come to terms with every day because intellectually I know I'll never be perfect, but I still hold myself to those expectations. But I've made all these mistakes in sobriety, and each time, as long as I stay sober, I've had the chance to learn from them. So today I'm a huge advocate of making mistakes because I didn't get sober to live in a bubble. I didn't get sober to never take any chances because for me, going to school is a chance. Getting in a relationship, having a friendship, having a sponsee, getting close with your parents, these are all risks. Pursuing your dream career. You know, these are all chances that we take and I want to take them because I have the opportunity from Alcoholics Anonymous to live my life to the fullest today. Because I have been given a sense of self that I never thought I deserved. I've been given the tools to go out and interact with people on a daily basis. And so I want to take advantage of that. I want to go and I want to live life. I want to fall down. I want to scrape my knees. I want to get hurt. I want to pick myself up and learn from it and become stronger. And so I get to go out and I get to make these mistakes because there is nothing I can do that you can kick me out of Alcoholics Anonymous for. But I get to live by spiritual principles today that guide my actions. And therefore, even if I make mistakes, I'm still trying to be the best person I can be that day, even if I fall short of my expectations. The last thing I'm going to talk about is God. And honestly, I call it God because I'm lazy. But I did not have a relationship with any sort of higher power until about 5 years sober. I would say some prayers once a month or so. I felt like praying in meetings counted. And I just did not have a working relationship with a higher power. And once again, pain is a touchstone of spiritual growth. I found myself at an AA camp out surrounded by hundreds of people that I loved, and I knew that talking to them was not going to lessen the pain that was inside of me. So I ended up in the middle of the night down by the river, leaning against the rock, looking up at the stars. And I came into this room hating the idea of God. Hating the idea of God. And I was able to take my second and third step by being willing to be willing to believe and kind of just went from there, but I had never formed any sort of relationship that I could do business with. I ended up by this river in the middle of the night completely by myself because I could not talk this pain away. And I looked up, and I didn't know what I was praying to, but I said, help me, and I started crying. And since then, and it's not like I didn't have a burning bush experience. I didn't have the voice of God come down and talk to me, tell me everything was going to be okay, nothing like that, but I had a tiny sense of relief. Since then, I have been able to maintain a working relationship with a higher power, and for me, that I try to do that on a daily basis, and that doesn't mean that I do, but I had to make it so simple that even I can't fuck it up, because I like to overcomplicate things, and so for me, if I'm running late and I don't have time to do my whole reading my meditation books and saying my prayers or whatever it is, if I'm in my car running late to work, all I have to say is, God, help me be who you need me to be today. I made contact. That's good enough for that moment. And since then, I mean, like, life hasn't been perfect in the past 2 years since I've made contact with the higher power, but I've been more even. I've been able to handle the things that life throws at me with a little bit more grace and dignity than I did before. And that doesn't mean that I still don't throw, like, temper tantrums when I feel like it, but I tend to do it in private now rather than in public. But more importantly, I don't feel alone anymore. I'm allowed to be, I get the privilege of being in a room of hundreds of other alcoholics and actually feel like I'm in a room of hundreds of other alcoholics instead of by myself. And for someone who could never be comfortable with anybody, ever, I get to have relationships today. I get to let you see who I really am and not be afraid that you're going to run screaming. That's enough for me. This program has given me more than I expected. More than I could have asked for. And I keep receiving every day because I get to look for the blessings in my life today. I have found that when I look for the negative, I find it. And when I change my attitude and I look for what I've been given and the blessings I have, my day's a lot brighter. I see more friendly faces. I see more smiles in the world. Oh my God, that was so cheesy. I'm sorry, I'm going to stop with that because, no, but really, I'm super grateful for this program. I'm grateful for SoCali Paw for asking me to come do this. If you're ever in the Bay Area, hit me up. I'll take you to a meeting. We do it right up there. Thank you for having me do this, and all I can ask is that you give this a shot, because if you can find even a fraction of what I found, you won't want to give it back.
Thank you, Courtney. And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker, Carl M. from Covina.
Good evening. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. You know, it's really really funny. My that's exactly what my ex-wife said to me when we left the courthouse. Along with a poon. Oh, God. Thank you, Brent. And, what am I doing here? Most conferences have their dance after the meeting. Did you guys know that? They usually have that afterwards. Anyway, you guys seem to have a lot of good time. I had a great time today with Ernestine and Ron playing golf and dinner, and good to see my friend Larry, who came out. I know him from Covina. Anyway, got to get this watch off that Larry loaned me. Trying to do in my mind exactly how long I got to go. All right. The most important thing I can tell you about myself is that I'm an alcoholic. Really is. I mean, I could talk to you about, you know, trying to be a good son, a good father, a good ex-husband. I could talk to you after breakfast about what it means to try to be a good ex-husband. I could talk to you about what I try to be an honest businessman in the community. Those are all important things. But the most important thing about myself is that I'm an alcoholic. It's the dominating factor of my life, drunk or sober, that I'm an alcoholic. And I've been sober half my life. So you guys got to do the math, figure out how old I am, then you'll know how long I am sober. But I have. I got sober at 25. I'm 50 years old now. So it's the dominating factor of my life, drunk or sober. And the reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is really, really simple. I'm an alcoholic because I've got a really bizarre relationship with alcohol, period. That's why I'm alcoholic. And this strange relationship that I have with alcohol takes on a couple of forms. The first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. A very strange thing happens when I drink booze. The book calls it an allergic reaction. And they say the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get when I drink booze is what they refer to as the phenomenon of craving. And the best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is that it seems like whenever I drink booze, the more I drink, the thirstier I get. Happens with nothing else, just booze. An example of that, got this cup of water, and over the next 45, 50 minutes that I'm talking with you, I'll probably drink this full cup, might even drink two cups of water. But I can absolutely guarantee you that once I finish this water, I'm not going to go get a case of water and lock myself in the hotel room. I'm not. I'm really not. But if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, this strange physical reaction that I get, if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, well then, Just Say No would have wiped out alcoholism, right? Early 80s, Nancy Reagan came up, said Just Say No. I would have, and I imagine you would have, ha! No. Right? And just gone on and lived a happy, successful life just saying no, right? Flocko calls up, says, good shit's in town. I said, well, no, Flocko, right? But I have this other strange part of my relationship with alcohol. And that happens when I'm not drinking. Up and by myself, if I don't drink for a day, a week, or a month, it seems like I have this mind that is able to rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs. And it doesn't matter about the pain, humiliation, and suffering of a day, a week, or a month ago. And it certainly never enters into the equation whether it was my pain and humiliation or your pain and humiliation. Does not matter at all. Sooner or later, my mind is able to paint a picture that makes it okay to take another drink. So I can't drink successfully because of this strange physical craving that happens, but I cannot, of and by myself, not drink successfully. I'm damned if I do. I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch-22 we call alcoholism. And I set this relationship up with alcohol that I just described to you right from the get-go when I first started drinking, and I started drinking a lot later than a lot of you guys. I was 11, right? I know some of you went to rehab at 11. Right? But we lived in Seattle, and a typical morning in seventh grade for me would be I'd show up early for school, not for study hall or anything, but to meet my new friends at the very edge of the school property, Loser's Corner. There's always a Loser's Corner at every school. It's about 10 feet off the school property. We'd be out there smoking cigarettes and trying to look cool. We'd also have what I like to call the playground cocktail. That is a jar full of whatever we could rip off out of the parents' liquor cabinet the night before, and that jar is pretty scary because nobody's been to bartending school yet. So there are equal amounts of whiskey, vodka, cream de menthe, vermouth all in that jar. There's green things floating around that jar. You can imagine, you can picture six or seven of us, 11, 12-year-olds, handing that jar around, choking it down. And of course it was the early 70s, so we're smoking that commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? Probably not, huh? You guys only smoke the Chronic, right? But there used to be this stuff that we called commercial pot. It would be $10 a bag, four-finger lids, seeds and stems, and it would be in a regular Glad bag, right? That as you'd roll it, even before Ziploc baggies or even the hermetically sealed stuff, that wasn't around yet, right? Regular Glad sandwich bag, and as you'd roll it up, there'd be like nine people spit on it like, oh, man. Now, it's at this point that many people that speak in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's at this point that they often interrupt themselves, and they say something like this: I don't mean to offend anybody, but drugs are a part of my story. I understand and have great respect for what they're attempting to do when they say that. They're attempting to protect singleness of purpose. Vitally important aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous should not be forgotten. And indeed, no individual or any group should represent to other people or the public as a whole that Alcoholics Anonymous is about anything other than recovery from alcoholism. We're kind of a one-trick pony organization, right? The name kind of indicates that. But that idea aside, I still think it's a bizarre practice for alcoholics to apologize to other alcoholics for doing drugs while drinking or in between drunks. I understand apologizing to police officers and judges and people that may still love us, but I don't know why we apologize to each other, for God's sake. In fact, the most bizarre example I've ever seen of that, it was a number of years ago. I was out in a meeting out in the west side of Los Angeles, big speaker meeting, and that night the speaker was just giving one of the most nasty, ugly, heinous, blow-by-blow drunkologues I've ever heard. And I got to tell you, when I'm out there listening to a speaker and the drunkologue starts to get ugly, the uglier it gets, the more excited I get. And I think that night I was on the edge of my chair drooling, looking up at this guy going, yeah, buddy, go, 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 go. And at one point in this really ugly story, this guy said, you know, I had four DUIs. And the judge said, if I get one more DUI, I'm going to prison for sure. He says, 2 weeks later, I'm on the freeway in a blackout. I hit a family of four. They all wound up in the hospital, and I wound up in prison. In prison, I sodomized men. I was sodomizing. I don't mean to offend anybody, but I did some drugs, too. I was the only one that thought that was strange that night. So anyway. By the time I'm 14 there in Seattle, I'm the neighborhood drunk, I'm the neighborhood pot dealer. I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. He was not chuckling. My parents, really good people, really good people, and they saw what was happening to me. It was no secret. I mean, by the time I'm 14, my hair is growing down in front of my very bloodshot eyes, down onto my shoulders, and my vocabulary at 14 is, whoa. Wow, whoa, right? That's my vocabulary. And I'm regularly locked in my bedroom listening to Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, getting all the necessary tools for living. And my parents tried to help, right? They tried to help, but they didn't understand that I was alcoholic. They blamed my problems on people, places, and things. They thought, if we can get him away from that damn group of kids he's hanging out with, things will get better. If we can get him out of that damn public school system, things will get better. They tried all of the above. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. My problems are not based upon people, places, and things. My problems are based upon my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. You see, if you change the people, places, and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is that I'm loaded with different people in different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. So my parents, when I was about almost 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle, and my parents decided that Seattle was the problem. If we get them out of Seattle, things would get better. So they sent me 300 miles away to Washington State University. And I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money, and in that 3 years, I got almost 10 credits. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content, is what was going on, about a 0.25. I'm not talking 2.5. That would be a C average. I would have been boasting about that. I'm talking 0.25. By the time I was 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish, my mother is Icelandic, therefore I look like a polar bear. And I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran, I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives. My parents would send out this big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. And when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas, and as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year, another impressive year, I'm sure. The next paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year, and that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in human resources. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's a very happy young woman. We are very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in marketing. He's now working for a large advertising firm in downtown Seattle. He loves the golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. It was small at one time. And they love to golf together. They love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We are very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. My parents are actually being rather kind there because they're the type of people that have the tendency to tell the truth. And if they were to have told the truth in that Christmas letter, what they would have had to have probably said in any given year in my early 20s is, we had told Carl not to come anywhere near our property. We made the mistake of going on a two-week vacation. We came home 2 days early. We walked in the door, the house was full of pot smoke, there was scales on the table, there was broken glass, and we saw Carl's naked ass running out the back door. So they just didn't want that in their Christmas letter. So they were actually being very kind. It's about this same time a really bad night happened. It would really take me till breakfast to describe what happened, but it was just one of the really bad nights. It was so bad that I joined the Navy. What I'm about to tell you should scare the living daylights out of you if you care anything about the security of the United States. But on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test. It's called the ASVAB test. And this test that I took qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should worry you. That the United States Navy has any system in place that will allow somebody like me to possibly, or even remotely, maybe, get near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base for boot camp, and I could not pass that test. It's called a urinalysis test. Never knew how to pass it. They kept me in the Navy anyway through a series of events. They should have kicked me out, but they kept me in anyway. And a year and a half later, I was a lower rank than when I first came in. You know, that can really happen to anybody, actually. But what would happen is, you see, when I'd be out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and I would look at my surroundings and I go, by God, I'm in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I'm on a big gray ship. Look at this. I'm in a uniform. No doubt about it. I'm in the Navy. I understood. I knew it. However, that ship would pull into a port. I would leave that ship and I'd take a drink and I would totally forget that I'm in the Navy. And I would come back to where I had last seen the ship when the drunk was over. And at this point in my life, I have no idea, once I take a drink, whether it's going to be like, you know, 3 hours, you know, have a few beers, smoke a little pot, you know, watch some cartoons, eat some Cap'n Crunch and like crash, or am I going to like take a drink and the next thing I know it's 3 days later, I'm naked in a motel room smoking crack with people I don't like. I just have no idea which way it's going to go. I have no idea which way it's going to go. And it's a very strange feeling. It's a very strange feeling being in a foreign country at 6 a.m. in the morning, standing on a large pier, and you're going,
Destroyer here the other day. Ship was back in port in San Diego, and I'd been drinking all weekend. I'd gone what they call liberty, that's like off of work, whatever, and I'd been drinking all weekend. I was late for work on a Monday morning. I was driving my car, being held together by rubber bands. And what there was this long straightaway before the front of the naval base, and at every naval base there is a guard shack, right? A Marine will stand guard in this guard shack, sometimes two Marines. And if you are going to bring your car onto the base, you need to pull up at that guard shack. He'll check your military ID. He'll check the sticker on your car. If everything's in order, he'll allow you to proceed onto the base. This particular morning, I was doing what I always do after a weekend of drinking, is I'm trying to get a half a pint in me to try to get through till noon, and I'd run back out to my car and drink the other half a pint. That's sort of my detox plan, my way to slide into Tuesday. And I was trying to get this half a pint in me, and I'm driving into the base, and I'm already, you know, this is one of those mornings, you know, and all of a sudden my eyes kind of got clear, and I looked, and the Marine had his head out of the guard check like, and I was wondering what was going on, until I looked down, I was still going 45 miles an hour. I tried to swerve, the car hit this median on the right-hand side, flipped over, and bam, right through that guard check. I can still see that Marine doing this big dive out of there. Marines are in very good shape, thank God. You know, he got out of the way, he was all right. They were patching me up at the hospital for minor injuries, and they were reading new charges on me, and this is nothing significant in my life. New charges, injuries, that's just what happens in a guy's life like mine about every 90 days if you're living the way I'm living. So there's nothing significant about that. But the most significant thing that happened that morning is the Navy doctors prescribed this stuff called Anabuse for me. Do you guys know what that is? Yeah. Do they still use that out there?
Yeah.
They prescribed this stuff called Anabuse for me, and I was now under orders to show up at sick bay every morning before quarters, and the corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour to make sure this Anabuse actually ingested in my system. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this illness we call alcoholism, and that is I had no alcohol or drugs in my system, and I was slowly going insane. So you take alcohol away from me and you do not give me Alcoholics Anonymous, the best way I can describe the way I feel is that I feel like a scream looking for a mouth. I literally feel like imploding from the inside out. And I had never, to this point, really experienced that much time of not drinking and knowing I can't drink. And I remember counting those days on that Anabuse, just... It's been 4 days, and I'm on Anabuse. Now it's been 6 days, and I'm on Anabuse. Now it's been 8 days, 6 hours, and 15 minutes, and I'm on Anabuse. And I started to look around that ship. The other men, they're talking behind my back. All 300 of them. Have you ever felt that way in AA? The only difference is that in AA, we are talking behind your back. It's not an illusion, we're really doing it. On the 10th day, I just snapped. I went AWOL from my ship. My solutions to my problems are always worse than my problem was originally. Went AWOL from my ship, locked myself in a hotel room in downtown San Diego. It's a Plaza Hotel. It's on 4th and Broadway. This would have been 1986. It was $13 a night. I checked a couple of years ago after they'd done the rehab on downtown San Diego, and it's now, I believe, $13.95 a night. Locked myself in a little hotel room, and I got a bottle of vodka and a shot glass, and I sat on the bed and I looked at this rickety little end table where the bottle of vodka was, and as I stared at it, I remembered that the Navy doctors had given me a very stern warning about drinking on top of Anabuse when they had prescribed it for me. They had told me, son, you need to understand that if you drink on top of this Anabuse, you will get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die. I remember looking at the bottle and I thought, well, wonder which reaction I'm going to get. I took one shot and nothing happened.
authority had lied to me again, as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure, and I took another shot. All of a sudden, I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room, and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going boop, boop, boop. Looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat, and all of a sudden, I was like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. You guys are sick if you think this is funny. Really, I got proof. I got proof. I'm going to skip ahead a couple of years. I'm coming back to this hotel room. I'm going to skip ahead a couple of years. 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first sponsor and his sponsor were real sticklers about step nine. One of the amends that I had not been able to make while I was still in the Navy was that my parents had paid for a bachelor's degree. I did not have one. I had two choices. Either pay them back every single nickel or to go get what they had paid for in the first place. I know that's bad news for some of you, right? So, when I got out of the Navy, I used some VA benefits and I went to college. And I was taking this telecommunications business bachelor's program. In the first couple of semesters, I had to take this business presentation course. It's like a speech class for giving business presentations. And in the first couple of days of this speech class, the instructor was randomly pointing at students, throwing them up in front of the room one at a time. He'd give them a topic to talk on, and we were supposed to talk for 2 to 3 minutes. The instructor was doing this just to see what he had to work with for the semester. So after about 7 or 8 students were thrown up there, he pointed at me, and I walked up to the front of the room. From the back of the room, the instructor shouted out, "Talk about a really bizarre situation in your life." So I told them about drinking on top of anabuse. They did not respond the way you guys responded. They were like, there were, though, a couple of guys in the back going, "Hey, right on, dude, right on." So anyway, I'm back in the hotel room. I'm red-faced. I'm hyperventilating. I'm sweating. And I took a shot. Took another shot. Next thing that happened to me, my late sponsor, Eddie Cochran, one of the pioneers of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous, he died in 1999 with 47 years of sobriety. He called what happened to me next projectile regurgitation. This is a different level of puking than we're all used to, right? You guys all know, when you're out there in the middle of a good drunk, you know, you get that little warning. Little sour taste comes up, right? Maybe a little bit up into your mouth, and you kind of, you go, And you know, based upon experience, you've got 30 seconds, maybe a minute, to find a bathroom if there happens to be one. If you're driving, you just got to get the window down. If it's your friend's shoe tonight, that's just the way it goes. But here on this anabuse, no warning at all. Just, boom. Kind of like a Linda Blair spray across the room. Now, thank God, though, the Plaza Hotel is the type of hotel room where the toilet is in the same room with the bed. It's a design feature, I believe, maybe to make convicts feel more at home upon release. I'm not really sure. But I found the magic of drinking on top of anabuse, that if you hang in there, and this part's important, you cannot half measure it if you're going to drink on top of anabuse. You need to hang in there. If I would keep drinking for about an hour to an hour and a half, enough of the anabuse would kick out of my system and I would quit throwing up and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating and sweating, and I'm pretty much all right with it. So I drank on top of anabuse the last 7 months of my drinking. The only words to describe this are desperation drinking. My second and my last drunk, I was left for dead in a motel parking lot in National City. You guys know where National City is? National City to San Diego is like South Central Los Angeles is to Los Angeles. Yeah, take a look at me. I'm in the middle of a 2-day drunk. It's 3 a.m. and I think, I should go look for some crack cocaine. So I start wandering the street. And you know what happened. Next thing I knew, lots of fists. Lots of fists. They were not mine. I'm always the kind of... Right? Then there was lots of blood, and apparently that was mine. And I was tumbling down some motel stairs, and I was left for dead in the motel parking lot. Next thing I knew is I came to. And you guys all know that when you come to, you start looking around your surroundings. Am I in jail? Am I in my own bed? Or, you know, who's that? You know, we always use that sort of... You guys ever heard in meetings when people are trying to describe pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and they go, oh, I'm so glad I'm sober now because when I wake up, I know where I'm at, I know who I'm with. God, when I was drinking, I would come to and I'd look next to me and go, ah! Right? And they're trying to describe that as some sort of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's not demoralization. Demoralization on the pitiful side is when you come to, you look next to you and go, wow, not bad. And they wake up and look at you and go, oh, God! And they run out. Right? There's always two sides to that story. This time I came to and I was on an operating table. My jaw was broken in three places. They were operating on me. And anybody in the medical profession knows that when somebody in my condition shows up, obviously extremely intoxicated but with a broken jaw, and I can't tell them what combination of drugs or alcohol in my system, it is illegal to use anesthesia. So therefore, I was having my face operated on with no anesthesia. That was a fun morning. My last night of drinking, I'm being let out of the San Diego jail, being transferred from civilian authorities back to military authorities. I'm in handcuffs, and there's lots of angry people around me. You know those mornings. It's also one of those mornings where the neck muscles aren't working too well, kind of like this. And that morning, they would not allow me on board my ship. They stopped the shore patrol on me, and they said, wrong answer. Orders have already been processed on this loser. The orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. Now, as I stood there in handcuffs, apparently some sort of option was thrown out on the table, right? The brig, 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. And as I stood there in handcuffs, I do not remember thinking, oh God, you are so good to a bum like me, I just can't go on this way anymore, and look at, you're offering me treatment. I don't remember thinking that at all. Nor do I remember thinking, and it would have been more likely that I would have thought, hey, if I just act like I want that treatment thing, maybe I can beat this rat too. That would have been more likely, but I don't remember that either. I now know that it would not have mattered what I was thinking that morning because I was in handcuffs. Now, I don't know about your experience in handcuffs, but my experience in handcuffs was always the same. Whoever had me in handcuffs, never once did they ever turn to me and say, so what's your opinion on this matter? It just never goes that way when you're in handcuffs. When you're in handcuffs, you go where they say. And I was taken up to this treatment center up at the north end of San Diego at the Miramar Naval Base. And when the doors were locked behind me, that's when they took the handcuffs off me. And that is what society feels about how Carl Morris acts out there in the world without Alcoholics Anonymous. And rightfully so. So anyway, we're going to do this 45-day treatment thing. And there's 35 of us over the next couple of days that showed up from various ships, bases, and commands. And we're all going to do this 45-day thing. And they're doing paperwork on us. They're doing medical checkups on us, and they also have us in this big group therapy session, right? We're all sitting in this big circle, and there's this assistant facilitator, I think he was new at his job, was trying to get us to talk. He was running out of things to say. He was trying to get us to talk, and none of us are talking. It's arms folded, looking down at the ground. We're not saying a word, and he's getting more frustrated by the day. And somewhere between the second and third day, this guy named Paco raises his hand in the therapy session and says, yes, I'd like to say something. And the facilitator got really excited. Oh my God, yes, Paco, what would you like to say? Paco said, I hear that I'm supposed to be rigorously honest with you guys if I'm going to do this staying sober thing. And I want you guys to know that Paco's not my real name. Paco's just a name I've always used when things look like trouble. And the other day when I got here, this really looked like trouble. But I want to be honest and upfront with you. You'll find out in a couple of days when my paperwork gets here anyway, but I want to be upfront with you. My real name is Randy. Will you guys call me Randy from now on? We all kind of go, yeah, like, whatever, nice to meet you, Randy. But this facilitator got really excited. Oh my God, this is the first breakthrough of any honesty of any of you SOBs. Later that afternoon, Randy was paraded in front of us. They slapped a gold name tag on him that said Randy, and then we were all informed that whenever staff was not around, Randy's in charge. And Randy loved his new job. And we all hated Randy. On the seventh day in this place, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least it was my first meeting that I'm aware of. And All I remember is we'd been in this place 7 days, and over the 1MC, it's like an intercom system through the barracks. They said, civilian closed, parking lot, 6 p.m. So we're all out there standing, five white vans pull up, and we were told, you know, five or six of us got in each van, and boom, out in town. Each van went to a different meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the van I was in pulled up at one of your meetings. We're sitting there in the back of the room, and you guys started your meeting. Now, down in San Diego, participation meetings, most of them are not, they don't allow you to share from your chair. You share up here. Now, I didn't understand that, and I didn't understand there were different types of meetings, speaker meetings, book studies, participation. I had no idea. All I know is a long string of people came up to this podium. And I don't remember much, but I do remember a few things. As I listened to what the first few people read, and then the remaining 10 or 12 people that went up there just talked off the cuff for like 3 minutes. No notes, no nothing. Just talked for 3 minutes and sat down. And as I listened to that, I remember sitting in the back going, feeling, oh my God, they know. They know. Jesus, they know. Now, if you would have seen me back there thinking, and you went up to me and said, so what is it that they know that you think you know? I would have said, I don't know. But they know. And what it was is I truly believe that those people in that meeting were sharing responsibly in that meeting, because I was, what was happening to me, and looking back, is that I believe what was happening to me right there is what Alcoholics Anonymous wants to happen to any brand new person that is sitting in a meeting that he doesn't even know where he is, really. What was happening is I was identifying, and I was identifying with two things. I was identifying with the way you described the way you drank, and even more importantly, I was identifying with the way you described the way you felt when you were not drinking. Those were the two things that were just hitting me between the eyes. The other thing that I remember from that meeting is this one fellow got called on. He walked all the way to the front of the room. And in the 24 years and 11 months that I've been here with you in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never heard the alcoholic mind described better than in that very first meeting. This fellow got called on, got up to the podium and said, my name's Jack, I'm an alcoholic. My mind would have killed my body a long time ago, except it needed it for transportation. And he sat down. Whoa. So the next night, they took us to another meeting. And as much as I identified at the first meeting, I got equally as confused at the next meeting. Because everybody at this meeting was talking about something called a drug of choice. People were saying, well, my drug of choice is, and somebody else went, well, my drug of choice is, and I'm sitting in the back saying, oh, for Christ's sake, was I supposed to be choosing out there? Do they want me to choose now? What in the hell are they talking about? So the next morning, I'm back at the treatment center. I asked the counselor who'd been assigned to us, her name was Mary. I go, Mary, last night in the meeting, they were talking about something called a drug of choice. What on earth do they mean by that? And she said, Carl, let's play a game. Now, that kind of worried me because she was now insinuating that I need to pay attention. And there was something going on that I didn't know how to describe. I now know what was going on. When they had done the medical checkup on me, they found out that my liver was extremely extended, my pancreas were shutting down, I had extreme alcoholic edema, where your skin is just full of it. What they had done is they had salted my tail with detox meds, right? And they'd done that so that I didn't, you know, like, throw the floppy fish right there in the middle of a therapy session and scare the other patients, right? It kind of ruins their day, they get scared. So they salted my tail with these things. It's that little cup of pills that you got to take, right? If you've ever been on those things, you know what I'm talking about. Your field of vision is just fine about like this. But there's dancing squiggly things over here. And when you turn to see what it is, now it's over here. So you're doing a lot of it. So when she said, Carl, we'll figure out where your drug of choice is, let's play a game, I went, okay. And she said, imagine this, Carl, imagine, she said, imagine I walked into this room and I had a tray. And on that tray I had a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take? Now if you're too young, Thai sticks are like the chronic of the 70s, all right? Got a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take? I started to drool immediately. Oh, I take them all! And she started to, she snapped her fingers. Settle down. Settle down, Carl. You can't have them all. Play the game. You can only have one. Which one would you take? And I thought for a second. I said, well, if I can only have one, Mary, I guess I'd take the ounce of cocaine. She said, ah,
maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. Do you understand now? And I said, no. He said, what's the problem? I said, well, Mary, the only reason I take the ounce of cocaine over the other two is, well, I take that ounce of cocaine, I get the hell out of this place, and I sell 2 8-balls. Now I have enough money for a quarter pound of Isaac and a case of Jack Daniels. Now, the only reason I bring that up is to bring up a very important aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you knew or fairly new, and that is, if you are going through that mental masturbation, am I an alcoholic and a little bit addict? Am I mostly addict and a little bit alcoholic? I know none of you are going through that. Look it. First thing you need to do is find somebody who understands the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that will sit down with you and go through the description of the alcoholic, which is from the beginning all the way to We Agnostics, and to find out what is alcoholism, so that you can make an educated, well-informed decision, am I alcoholic or am I not? Right? However, in the meantime, this might be bad news for some of you, I don't know. No matter what you think your drug of choice is, there's only one sobriety day. I know there's probably lots of people in here that work with lots of new people, and in my home group in Covina, every once in a while, not very often, I kind of get this response when I go up to a guy and say, hey, good to see you, how long you got? Every once in a while, not often, I get this response. Well, my drinking sobriety date is January 4th. My pot clean date is May 3rd. Oh, I blew my methamphetamine date last night. I was in Walmart all night long. No. One sobriety date. Funniest thing I ever heard about sobriety day, same scenario. Saw this guy around my home group for a while, went up and said, hey, good to see you. How long do you got? He said, well, I had 90 days, but I drank last night, so now I have 89 days. I had to think about that one for a second myself. I was like, I almost had to call my sponsor and check up on that one. I think that kind of falls under the same category as being down in Mexico looking at the tequila going, would that affect my U.S. sobriety date? Yes! Yes! Sobriety dates are international. Just a little information for the new guy. Anyway, after 45 days, they let us all out of this treatment center. That's just what the orders were. And everybody was they let us out on a Friday. And on the Wednesday before that Friday, they gathered all 35 of us, they put us in this room, and the biggest, meanest counselor in the place walked in through a side door. And this guy's a Marine. And that day, he's wearing his full dress uniform, medals and all. And I got to tell you, a Marine in his full dress uniform, very impressive, very intimidating sight. He walked in that room, and we all went, just went silent in the room. Walked up to a podium in front of us, leaned over it, and just stared at us. Panned the room, didn't say a word for like 2 minutes, just looked at us. Then he finally spoke. He said, you 35 have been through one of the finest treatment centers in the world for alcoholism and drug addiction, and the treatment center has been here for many, many years. And over the years, this treatment center's statistics have shown us that out of you 35, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Many of you will die, go insane, wind up in prison. Nice little exit pep talk, don't you think? For God's sake. Then he said, many of you will relapse once, twice, maybe 20 times and make it back into long-term sobriety, but according to this treatment center statistics, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Man, if you thought it was quiet before he said that, you could have heard a pin drop in the room now. The only thing you could hear was me going, shit. Because I knew if only one of us was going to make it, it was not going to be me. We all knew who it was going to be. It's going to be Randy over here, guaranteed. He's like the poster boy of the treatment center by now. So on this Friday afternoon, people are taken back to their ship's base and commands in various different ways, and there was about 4 or 5 of us that had been arrested in vehicles the night before we were thrown into this place, and we were informed that we were told to stand on the front doorstep of the treatment center and our vehicles would be brought out of this impound lot where they'd been for the last 45 days. So I'm standing there with a few guys, kind of looking at each other, waiting for our cars, and all of a sudden one of the guys that I'm with points at this car that's coming across the parking lot. He goes, is that Randy in that car? Yeah, sure enough. One of the other guys says, he's drinking already! Sure enough, Randy's got himself a bottle. He's polishing it off. Rolls right in front of the doorstep, right in front of us, rolls down the window, throws the empty right at our feet. Crash! We look up, he gives us all the finger, and he drives right off. Guess his name was Paco again. I don't know. Next thing that I remember of that day is I showed up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, a 6 o'clock gong show meeting in Pacific Beach. Truth about my life. Truth about my life. So I'm sitting in the back of that room and I don't know anybody. Truth about my life is I'm 45 days without a drink. I got a lot of information and I'm physically feeling better than I have felt since I've been a young kid. There have been no spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, or even a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. I had 45 days, information, and I was feeling better. Dangerous, dangerous, dangerous. If there was ever a turning point in my life, it was right there in that meeting that night. Which way is my life going to go? One guy that night operating his primary purpose found me sitting in the back, came over to me and said, "Hey, never seen you here before. What are you doing?" I didn't think quick enough to lie to him because I promised if I would have thought for one more second, I would have lied to him. But I accidentally told him the truth and I said, "I don't know, man. I just got out of a Navy treatment center this afternoon. I don't know what I'm doing." This guy's eyes went bing, big smile went across his face. At the break, he's like fighting his friend. "He's mine, he's mine. I got him. I didn't know there's guys in AA that lurk around meetings trying to find a new guy who accidentally admits he doesn't know what he's doing. But there was something else going on in this guy's life that particular Friday night that made him especially glad to meet me. This guy's girlfriend had left him the night before for one of his friends in his home group. So he was wondering what he was going to do with his weekend. Homicide? Suicide? Get loaded or grab his sneaker? He's like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy was insane over this woman. In between each meeting, he would throw me in the passenger side of his car and he'd start driving and he'd start yelling. And he wouldn't even look at the road. He had just like one of those AA radar cars that just made it to the next meeting, I guess. Wouldn't even look at the road and he'd start yelling at me. "You gotta go to me, you gotta read the book, you gotta get a sponsor. God damn her! You gotta go to me, you gotta go to me, damn her!" Now, I didn't know it, but I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breaker is what I'm getting. But I'm so very glad that that guy that night in his pain was a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, had taken the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So therefore, he understood that the solution to his pain was out of self, out of self, out of self. I am so glad that that guy that night in his pain was not at home underneath his covers whining into his sponsor's answer machine. "Sponsor, where are you? Call me. Get me a match lighter." Right? I'm sure he found his sponsor in that barrage of meetings we went to. I don't know. He was always talking to these old guys in the corner at the break. Some of them would be going, Other ones would be going, "Ha ha! Ha ha!" Invariably, they turned him around. They point at me, he'd come barreling, "We're going to another goddamn meeting." By going to so many meetings in the same area of town with that guy, I learned something really valuable about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new. By going to so many meetings in the same area of town, I saw other people that were going to multiple meetings over that weekend. Now, I didn't see anybody else doing 18 meetings, just me and that guy. But I saw other people that were at two or three meetings over that weekend. And what I learned about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new, I'm going to correlate it to a football game. Now, a football team is out there on the field for one reason and one reason only, to win the game. And how do they win that game? They huddle up, they make a plan, and they do one play. Then they huddle up again, they make another plan, and they do one play. That's exactly what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. The game around here is one day without a drink, you're a big winner. And how do we do that one day? We run in here and we huddle up. We go, "Remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. Break!" And we go out there and we try a little of this and we try a little of that. We run right back in and we huddle up. We go, "Remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows." And just before we break, some guy in the corner goes, wait, hang on. "I've been here for 6 months. I'm sober, but I'm broke and I'm bored." Some old timer will get up and say, "Get a job, son. Break!" Anyway, I get back to my ship after that weekend, and the one other sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous on my ship was waiting for me. His name was Bob W. He became my first sponsor even before I asked him. Just one of those kind of guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. He had 14 months of sobriety. He had a sponsor. He had commitments. He was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am so very glad that the one other sober guy on my ship was not a guy who hadn't been to a meeting in 9 months, didn't quite know what to do with me. I was so glad that one other sober guy on my ship when I got there was a guy who was already doing the deal. Because all he had, he was living a way of life where all he had to do to effectively help save my life was stick his hand out and say, come do what I'm doing. That's a really valuable way of life. Who else on this planet, with whatever level of education or level of respect that the community gives, can stick their hand out to the dying and say, come do what I'm doing, and effectively help save their life? Name it. Who? Us. We're the only ones that can do that. It's really important that if you have found this solution, that we take our seats in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh. My first 6 months of sobriety were meeting, coffee. And you might find me in the middle of the night, whether I'm on the ship in my rack or I'm in a motel room to get off the ship, but you might find me at midnight holding my gut, going, man, what's the matter with me? This is what sobriety is. I don't know if I can do it. I'd run to meeting, coffee, meeting. And I would run from each meeting to meeting, hoping that you would say something funny, clever, or insightful, that I would get this feeling of, oh, I'm okay. No, I'm not. Meeting, coffee. What I was doing was for months, I was running around Alcoholics Anonymous with untreated alcoholism and didn't even understand it. That's when you're holding your gut going, what's the matter? And you know, some of the things that you guys would say, because you would show up at meetings no matter what was going on in your life because you understood the value of this gift, and you would be there. And one night, there was one night where I was really thinking of just killing myself. And I don't usually feel that way, not at all. I think about killing you, not myself, right? This one night it was just bad. And I went to a late night meeting, and this old timer got called on the ship, and he said, if there's anybody out there that's thinking of committing suicide, I have it on good authority. Now, when an old-timer says that, he means good authority of God, I swear. I have it on good authority that however you are feeling when you commit suicide is how you will feel for all of eternity. Oh, that was bad news. That was really, really bad news. But he's a responsible member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He never presents the problem without already having the solution. So he followed that up with, so the solution to that is, wait till you're having a really, really good day, then do it. And I remember this feeling came over me of just, oh my God. And I started to laugh right from the bottom of my soul. And I had not felt that in so, so long since I'd been a young kid. My spirit was dead. No wonder the steps say, having had a spiritual awakening. That's exactly what the steps are about. My spirit is dead. That thing that makes me, that thing that makes you, it's dead. It's absolutely dead. Can't see the colors of life, can't hear the music, and can't connect with you. That's what our spirits are here for, to see the colors of life, to hear the music of life. Boy, did I hear it before this meeting. Bam. All right. And to connect with you. And I couldn't do that. The only time I could feel that is somewhere between the fifth and seventh drink. That's when all of a sudden, I'm here. See, I don't drink to escape. I drink just to get in the game. I don't drink not to feel. I drink to feel. I want to feel what I think you're feeling. And somewhere between five and seven drinks, that's when I feel it. And when I don't got it, it's just, my spirit was dead. What happened to me is our ship had to go out to sea for an extended period of time. My first sponsor, Bob W., told me I needed to meet him in the aft end of the ship down in the battery shop every night at 6:30 p.m., way down in this little engine room. And he showed up with that blue book, tossed it down on the table, and said, hey, been hounding about it for months. Have you read it? And I said something stupid like, yeah, there's like how it works, we antagonist, some doctor with some opinion about something. And what he did, remember, he only had 14 months. Right? He was no expert at working. I was going to be the first one he was working with. He didn't really know what he was doing. And what happened over the next 21 days was in looking back, as I call it, Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form. There was two guys in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, down in this little engine room, with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the blind leading the blind, trying to have an experience with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened, you know, we would go, he tried to share what little he knew, but it was in the effort and in the trying. You see, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried it to carry this message. It does not say we get certified as an expert or don't you dare try. Right? And maybe you are really uncomfortable about carrying the message. Maybe you really aren't at a point where you are even comfortable trying. If you got a car, really valuable. Grab the new person and you carry them to where the message is being carried and you will both get it. Right? And he really, really tried. So, one of the first things that happened to me by going through that Big Book is that although I would still get that feeling of, God, I'm trying to shove that feeling down, I got the beautiful gift of not having to say, what's wrong with me? That was huge. I now, because I had read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I now understood alcoholism. That's what's wrong with me. Huge. Because if I don't know what that is, that when I'm not drinking, I don't know what's wrong. That's what's wrong. If I don't know what that is, how can I look for a solution? The other thing that I learned at this time, I'll never forget it, is that if I found this solution at any level, and I'm reasonably armed with some facts about myself, I have a responsibility to be in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because only we can help us. Nobody else can help us. Doesn't matter how well educated, how well meaning, or how spiritual they are. Only we can help us. There's a magic that happens between one alcoholic when he's sharing with another that happens nowhere else. And how I learned that, I'll never forget. My first sponsor, Bob, and I would always, when we would pull into foreign ports, we would split a hotel room just to get off the ship. This time we're in Victoria, British Columbia. We split a hotel room. We went out to the AA club. And after the meeting, Bob said, you know, God, I'm not feeling well, Carl. I'm going to head back to the hotel room. I stayed with the AAers, went to another meeting, went out to eat. I don't remember. But an hour or two later, I come back to the hotel room. And Bob had found this other guy from our ship named Blair. And he found him in a gutter. Blair was, like, full of puke, and he's wasted. And Bob has him on my bed, propped up against the headboard with, like, a chair and an end table and a pillow. Right? And Blair's like... And Bob's at the end of the bed reading the Big Book to him. And I look at this and I go, oh, for God's sake, Blair doesn't even know where he's at. This is ridiculous. But I threw my 2 cents in, and then we did the old thing of two Navy guys carrying his guy back to the ship. We got him into his bed back on the ship. And that's the last I heard of Blair for a few weeks. We're back in Port San Diego, 3 a.m. in the morning, and all of a sudden I'm they're sleeping all of a sudden on the side of my bed. wake up. It's like, what? And it's Bob. And he goes, Blair's on the Coronado Bridge. We got to go get him. Apparently, over the last couple of weeks, Blair's tried to drink, he's tried not to drink. He's tried to drink, he's tried not to drink. He's at the jumping off point. He's up on the Coronado Bridge. And I don't know if you guys know about the Coronado Bridge. It's such a popular suicide spot that they actually have suicide hotline phones up the top, just in case you change your mind. They're kind of hoping that your feet are still on the ground when you change your mind, right? And Blair had gotten onto that phone. And this is what Blair was telling the well-meaning, highly educated suicide hotline counselor. Blair was saying, I will only talk to Bob W. Counselor's going, who's Bob W? Blair was saying, it's anonymous. So she went to go get her boss. They did the good cop, bad cop, fired questions right quickly. They found out he's from the Navy. What ship he from? So they took a stab in the dark. Right? They called down to the quarterdeck of the ship, 3 a.m. in the morning. They said, you know, is there a Bob W. on that ship? Now, my first sponsor, Bob, he would guard your anonymity of that level of the ship, but he would not guard his own, so he could be of service at any time. So with the guy who answered, out of the 300 men, the guy that answered said, yeah, Mr. 12 Steps, we know all about him. So they go out and get Bob. Bob goes, car, so we hop into Bob's car. We start driving down to the base of the Coronado Bridge, and as we're driving down, Bob goes, Carl, get the Big Book out of the glove box. Bone up on working well. We're like, all right. Said, forget it, we're going to win. So I throw it back in the glove box. We get down to the base of the Coronado Bridge. Everything that San Diego County has available for a situation like this is there. Fire department is there, police department is there, paramedics are there. The on-duty psychologist is there. And we walk up through this like gated area and we get let through and we're walking up and the fireman who seems to be in charge of one of you, Bob W. Bob goes, yeah, that's me. Fireman goes, I don't know what you're going to do. We've been talking for an hour and a half and you ain't budging. But here, hands him this little speakerphone contraption. Bob says, Blair, you can hear it through the speaker. Bob, is that you? Bob says, yes, Blair, it's me. Now get the hell down from that bridge. And you okay. One alcoholic can affect another alcoholic like no one else can. Don't forget that. 2 years sober, got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. That is a result of an apparently loving and merciful God. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and a personnelman that lost half my file. That's how that happened. As I told you, I moved up to Covina to go get a bachelor's degree and as I was driving up there, I still had the same car at 2 years sober that I had when I got sober, 68 Volkswagen, hole in the floorboard, had to push start the thing, and I'm puttering along, sitting on one or two cylinders, and I'm driving up the 5 freeway, and you know, cars are honking at me, get out of the way, asshole! And I start thinking, you know what, I need to get a life. I really need to get a life. I've heard people talk about having a life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need one of those. I'm going to go get one of those. And when I get a life, I'll get more active in AA. But I'm going to be way too busy. I'm going to go to school. I'm going to work. I'll stop by some meetings when I get a chance. And here I'm driving. I decide I'm going to, where in the town, Covina, I'm going to look for where the meeting hall is. So if I need a meeting, I can find it. And I pulled into the 502 Club in Covina. And I was very discouraged that it was, we affectionately call it the sobriety camp of the world. Yeah. Larry, right. I was very discouraged because the parking lot was flat. Because one of the tools for living when you're push starting your car is you don't like flat parking lots. Pulled in, I went into the noon meeting and I was sitting in the noon meeting and this man that was making coffee at that noon meeting walked over to me and he had this medallion. It said 1951. I knew what that meant. That meant he got sober 10 years before I was born. And he was making coffee at that noon meeting, and he came over to me and he said the very same thing that that fellow said to me when I was fresh out of the treatment center. He said the same thing. He said, hey, never seen you before. What are you doing? This time I had a much better answer. I said, sir, very nice to see this meeting hall. I'm 2 years sober. I'm fresh out of the Navy. Moved here to go to college, and I'm going to be real busy. I'm going to be going to school. I'm going to be working. You won't see me much. I'll stop by when I get a chance or if I need a meeting, but I'm going to be busy. I need to get a life. And Eddie just laughed. If you ever knew him, you'd know this laugh. And he just laughed. He said, oh, son, school and work. That's wonderful. But that's what we do in between meetings. What he was really telling me is one of the secrets to being comfortable, sober, long term. And that is that I need to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world. Instead of trying to hash it out there in the world and visiting Alcoholics Anonymous when convenient. Right? Now, when I say living in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not talking about you got to go to the morning attitude adjustment meeting, the noon meeting, the 5 o'clock happy hour, the 7 o'clock book study, and the 8:30 candlelight, and get a job behind the AA club counter. That's not what I'm talking about. If you're doing that, fantastic. Great. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a spiritual centeredness of knowing who and what I am and where everything in my life centers and honoring that. Honoring the fact that I'm a sober alcoholic who's been given an amazing gift. And I need to put that first. Oh, God, I can really sum up a lot of it here real easy. This must have been in, 1998. And I was asked to go down to Nogales, Arizona to do what I'm doing right now, right? Are you from Nogales? I won't make a joke about it then. But this is back in the late 90s when people carried pagers, right, that had nationwide coverage that certain areas of the country didn't work, and Nogales was an area where the pager didn't work, right? So I called my mom before I left and said, Mom, I'm going to be down in Nogales, Arizona, and I don't want you to worry if you page me and I don't call you back, right? And silently I'm thinking, I've worried you half my life. I don't want to do that anymore, so this is why I'm calling you. She goes, oh, God, yeah, Nogales, Carl, you need to call up Don and Leona. And I go, remind me who they are. Oh, that's right, you haven't seen them since you were 9 years old. Don was the best man at your father's and my wedding. They've been lifelong friends. They would love to hear from you. So I called up Don before I left, and I go, Don, this is Carl Morris. I'm going to be just about 30 miles south of you. Maybe we can get together for some coffee or some lunch. He goes, oh, Carl, I know you love to golf. Bring your golf club. I was thinking, how does he know that? I haven't seen him since I was 9, but it's true. I'm like a golf whore. I'll golf with anybody at any time for any reason, right? Don't even need to know your name. I'll golf with you, right? But I thought it was strange he knew that, but I brought my golf clubs, and on Saturday morning I left the conference. I drove up the freeway, and I met up with him at his golf course, and as we started to walk along, like through the first four holes, he was asking me very specific, pertinent questions about my life. I mean, he knew what school I graduated from, what my degree was in, what companies I'd been with, the recovery homes I'm involved with. He just knew everything about my life. And I was trying to squeeze in a couple of questions with him about what, you know, why he'd left Duluth and what he'd retired from it, but I didn't know anything. But he knew everything about my life, and by the fourth hole I got done, I'm confused. I haven't seen you since I've been 9 years old, yet you know all this about my life. How do you know all this? He goes, easy, Carl. I get the Christmas letter every year. I'm like, yeah! Finally I got in that damn thing. Look at you young guys, women, I do not know what you need to do. I've learned this very, very hard way. I do not know what you need to do. But men, young guys, really, I have no idea what you guys need to do. But you guys, here's a little piece of advice when you're dealing with your mom. We owe our moms. Big time. Big time. And there's four things that we owe our mothers. First thing. We owe our mothers a good night's sleep. We need to live our life in a way that they do not now have to listen to every single siren that's off in the distance, scared in the middle of the night when the phone rings. We need to live our life in a way that gives her a good night's sleep. Second, the money. You owe her the money. You owe her the money. No matter what you think, you owe her the money. I know, she kicked you out at the tender age of 32, but you know, hey, you owe her the money. Next, we need to live our lives in a way that when her friends ask her how we're doing, she can tell them something. Not look away in embarrassment. She deserves that. Last thing, we need to live our lives in a way that we can tell our mother, in your older years, Mom, I'll take care of you. You don't need to worry. You took care of me for the first 32 years. I will, and I'm not saying anything grand. Maybe it just means you've got an extra bedroom in your apartment that you can tell your mom, if worse comes to worse, be all right. But you know what? If you do all these things, you're not going to probably have to worry about that, because by you staying sober, you're going to save your mother about 20 grand a year in like bail money and lawyer's fees, and she's going to be just fine in her older years if you stay sober. I also promise you that if you live your life according to that, you will find what it means to be a man. You will know what it means to be a man in the community. You will know what it means to tell the truth. You will know what it means to show up no matter what. And I promise you, you find that first in Alcoholics Anonymous. God bless. Have a good night.
All right, let's thank Carl again for a great time. And let's thank Courtney again also, our 10-minute speaker. All right, and now Dusty H. will read a portion of Chapter 2 and close the meeting with the Serenity Prayer.
Dusty alcoholic.
Hey, Dusty.
I like it. Where's that, right here?
Yes, sir.
Perfect. I want to welcome everybody to Coachella Valley. It's awesome to have us here. And have a great, safe weekend. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupants are represented, as well as many political, economical, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to the captain's table. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. After a moment of silence, please join me in the Serenity Prayer.